Right now, it is time to bring in our good friend, David Terajuk. And David joins us every week at this time with the Media Beat. David not only joins us here, you can also get David on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on on-demand, the Media Beat with David Terajuk. He has his own terrific website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And he joins us this morning. Good morning, David.
Well, hello. Glad to be reporting in again from the media capital of the world, New York City, and joining the always clear-sighted Marshall Miles. Well, Wednesday, February 16th, came and it went, Marshall, with no Russian invasion of Ukraine yet, we should perhaps say. What do you think?
Well, you know, the latest, this is saber-rattling to its extreme. The latest now is, in addition to what's going on at the Ukraine, Putin now is overseeing a test of their ballistic and cruise missiles. This is just to ratchet up, I think, his unbelievable attention to the folks in Europe, to show the mighty power of Russia. And it also takes a little bit away from what's happening in the Ukraine. But it's going to be interesting to see if diplomacy will work in this case, or if they invade, and NATO all joins together in Europe and the United States and other countries. This is really something to watch very closely.
Well, sure, and the combination of diplomatic efforts with, as you say, the saber rattling at both the on the ground level of Ukraine itself and on the in the realm of ballistic missiles generally. But it's strange to see in this particular week to see such a specific piece of information like the actual canvas invasion day date. 16th, based evidently on intelligence agency findings, to be put out to the press by the Biden administration officials, conveying what they believe or think they believe or want to say that they believed that Russia would do. So the Ukraine watch is, of course, completely dominating our media landscape. But I'm finding it a bit strange that so many U.S. media outlets are talking about how unprecedented it is for, in this way, for intelligence findings to be shared in such detail with the press. I'm afraid it has been forever thus in real life, as the kids say. It goes on all the time, mostly on an anonymous basis, with officials whose job it often is to do exactly that kind of sharing with the press. And the press is very willing to go along with it, of course. And sometimes this sharing is very, very definitely open, public sharing of intelligence, and at a very top level, too. We can go right back to, you remember, President Kennedy revealing the U-2 spy plane photographs of Soviet missiles in Cuba in 1962. And, of course, there's the far less justifiable piece of informing the public in 2003 when Secretary of State Colin Powell went on television from the United Nations, even wielding his little glass vial to suggest a biochemical weapon of mass destruction, possibly anthrax powder. He was publicly sharing America's so-called intelligence evidence that could justify invading Iraq and deposing Saddam Hussein. It's interesting that only yesterday, Biden's Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, was at the UN exhibiting intelligence evidence. But it was interesting to note he deliberately distanced himself from Colin Powell, saying, in my case, what did he say? I'm here to not to start a war, but to stop one. So, you know, today's propaganda arguments go on right now. I mean, it's very clear Vladimir Putin has a very evident readiness to invade Ukraine, but the questions are still in the air. Are Russian troops still moving in a build-up mode, or could they even be returning to base? A likely story from the Kremlin, you might say sarcastically. And is the spike in shelling, of artillery shelling in eastern Ukraine a worsening or not of the ongoing ceasefire breaches that have been a feature of the separatist conflict that's continued ever since the peace agreement, that's called the Minsk Agreement, broke down in 2015? The answers are unclear. It's a case, once again, I'm afraid, for that terribly overused journalistic get-out phrase. Only time will tell.
You know, it's interesting because I think what you're pointing out here is that governments are now using, in my opinion, on top of diplomatic pressure that they put in the background, all the governments, the United States, Russia, NATO, are using the press to forward and mold opinion, which we have seen now in the past 20 years, that molding of opinion hasn't necessarily been accurate.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and as I say, it has been forever thus. And I don't think it's any surprise that we should see all the blaring of semaphore and signaling that we're getting. The press has a very hard job to do here. It's tough to be on the ground. You can't often see the very things you're meant to be reporting on the ground because you're on the ground. So much of this war is being fought at the level of, as I say, signaling at 30,000 feet level almost, or at least metaphorically speaking, that's true. But let's turn to the domestic news. I think it's interesting how much of the news this week within the United States has been largely about legal eagling. Legal eagles are ruling the roost. We can start in your own home territory with the 2012 Sandy Hook school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, and the settlement arrived there this week with the now bankrupt gun maker, the Remington Company. And it raises, for the first time, the prospect of real liability being faced by arms manufacturers, don't you think?
Yeah, it's taken a long time. And, of course, money does not replace lives. Money does not replace what future families might have been. But what money does in this case is, you're exactly right, it sets up a precedent that in the future, these companies have to be very wary and have to maybe take a look at a way that they can contribute to lessening the gun violence, especially from semi-automatic weapons. It sets a very severe precedent for the future. Does it really help the families out? You don't ever replace 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old children that would have gone on to be mothers and fathers and grandchildren. But you can start to set the agenda for the future.
Right, and the argument is the really important one. The argument that was being used by lawyers for the 9 families of people killed at school, the 5 of the children killed and some of the adults. The arguments have centered on the claim that the gun used by the 20-year-old shooter was the Remington Company's Bushmaster XM15. It was marketed in a particular way, according to this argument, that the company and its marketeers used an interesting term the lawyers were using, militaristic and hyper-masculine selling lines or slogans. And that includes disturbing the kind of exhortation, I guess, is the word for it, headlined in Remington's own catalog, saying, "Control your destiny." That slogan would, go alongside a picture of the gun, the Bushmaster itself. Control your destiny with a gun. That's a daunting idea. And it could well appeal to many a young man who felt unable to control his own life, like the 20-year-old who did the shooting. The lawyers have been arguing that the marketing style is designed, in fact, to play on young men's anxieties, suggesting how a gun can provide power assertive leadership, and it helps you. And I quote again here: react with proven confidence. That's another slogan from the catalog. This young man sector of the manufacturers market is seen amongst the gun marketers themselves as a vital target, and they've labelled it the tactical market to distinguish it from the generally older skewing traditional hunting community. And the language, and I want to really concentrate on the language here, the language is drawn from idioms that prevail amongst military and law enforcement circles, especially perhaps among young males who are military and law enforcement wannabes, fantasists perhaps. Remington has been careful in time since 2012 to take out of circulation some of the worst and most condemning examples of their marketing. So we're not seeing them reproduced so much now. But as my colleague at the Media Beat, Jess Burke, found out when he went digging, some of them are pretty damn compelling. And they might have been decisive if the case had actually gone to trial before a jury. For instance, there's one very telling image of a Bushmaster and the slogan, "Consider your man card," reissued. I didn't realize you needed it. We needed a man card, Marshall, did you?
No.
It's an extraordinary piece of advertising. Another slogan. Let me draw attention to that. It's almost puerile in its fantasist feel. Let me quote it again. Forces of opposition bow down, alongside a picture of the weapon. I could say, and I will say, that increasingly but all too easily ignored or forgotten important phrase, words matter. And nothing made it more clear, I think, than one Sandy Hook parent who told the press conference this week about the settlement. The phrase that the parent used was that the company used reckless marketing tactics that appeal to at-risk and violence-prone young men. Marketing that is targeted to those who want to appear more intimidating, more powerful, and more masculine through their use of their AR-15 guns. And that was the mother of a six-year-old child, Dylan, who was shot dead. The argument is an important one, and as you say, it opens up a precedent for the manufacturing field as a whole. And there's a very important background to this settlement, the way it was actually conducted, the legal negotiation, if you like, was conducted. The family's lawyers tried to get all of Remington's internal policy documents on this marketing strategy of theirs. In what's known as the legal discovery process, you know, when one side in a case is obliged to share information with the other side, legal observers have been suggesting that this led to one of the company's biggest tactical mistakes, if I can use that word tactical here, in a heavily ironic way. The company did hand over a massive tranche of 46,000 documents to the other side. But it was stacked. They'd stacked it with over 30,000 totally irrelevant pages, including several thousand that were just random cartoons, in the words of people who saw them. Now, this is a very old, familiar, and rather crude attempt to bury the opposition's legal team in documentation and consume them in some time-wasting distraction. And of course, it outraged lots of people, and I think it could well have helped to sway the scales of justice in the family's favor. And what's very important is, of course, that there's long-standing federal protection that gun makers have enjoyed for decades, thanks to the U.S. Congress, have now been pierced by a state court system. Congress's Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, to give its full name, has now got a sizable chink in it. It's quite a precedent, as you say.
All right. Let's move on to the courts and let's move on to the Trump. The New York Attorney General and the courts say that the Trump family can be deposed. And James' attempt to find out about the finances, and of course Donald Trump will appeal that, and it probably won't happen anytime soon. But the pressure is mounting on the Trump family and the Trump organization, especially when their own firm comes out and says, "Hey, the numbers just aren't reliable."
Sure, the legal eagles are circling. And yes, three Trumps ordered to obey the subpoena that New York's Attorney General Letitia James had been trying to get enforced. And now in the New York Supreme Court, that's been decided by a New York state judge. Three Trumps, of course, Trump Sr., Donald Trump Jr., and Ivanka Trump. And they have to sit within 31 days, 21 days, 3 weeks, for a deposition under oath, which could be interesting. Now, whether it's actually going to happen within those days or whether a legal effort by the Trumps themselves to, at the very least, delay it, that is a very classic Trump tactic, of course, to seek to delay any legal action until they sometimes are able to run off the clock. it's more than just the court ruling that they face, practical defense situation on the ground is weakening for them. Their long-standing accountants, Mazars USA, is now separating itself from the Trumps, saying that an entire decade's worth of their accounts are now not to be relied upon. That was an interesting phrase. They don't say there was a tissue of lies, which they could have done, I suppose, but they are saying that the accounts are not to be relied upon. And of course, if a deposition was taken from any of these three Trumps, there will be very serious questioning about how they valued their assets upward in some cases when it was in their interest to do so, and those same assets were downvalued in situations where it would suit them to have a lower value. That smacks very strongly of fraud to many a lawyer, and that's the line that will be pursued.
You know, I want to move to the Canadian border, and it appears that this is all calmed down a lot. But the blockades that we're taking at the one bridge and other bridges, those blockades, and I think this is something that a lot of Americans don't understand. Those blockades were finally taken down by the Canadian government, but that, you know, you take a look at what gas prices are here now. Our gas prices went from $3.49 a gallon to $3.75 in the past 2 weeks. These blockades in and out have pushed the car industry in this country back unbelievably. Did the United States and Canada work together to end these blockades? Because I can't believe it was just Canadians that were blocking those bridges.
Well, I don't think there were either, but it was the Canadian authorities' responsibility to take action on it. The blockage was technically on the Canadian side, on that connection between Detroit itself and Canada was the choke point. And yes, it took a while, but the Canadian authorities did something rather uncharacteristic for themselves. They they took a deep gulp. And decided to put aside the very strong concern that there is in the country for free speech, and go along with the arguments that certainly the truckers and all the associated extreme groups that gathered behind this set of protests said that free speech is in this case less important than the vital commerce between our two nations, and the choke point was loosened quite effectively, and although there was some talk of there being a violent reaction to that, that didn't happen, and the Canadian law enforcement were able to enforce the law and get the crossings cleared. Now it's less easy in Ottawa itself. I mean, there you've got whole neighborhoods choked with protesting 18-wheelers blaring their horns all the time, making life very difficult, a major level of nuisance. And we have yet to see whether that's going to get fully resolved there. But certainly, at the point where it mattered most economically, and that, as you say, was a major concern for governmental governmental level between the two countries, that was sorted out rather briskly, unusually briskly for the Canadians, you might say. But we still have to see what's going to happen in Ottawa.
Right now, in the final few minutes, you've been involved and covered conflicts in Northern Ireland and around the world. I think a lot of Americans don't understand something, and that is the size of the Ukraine. I think Americans are familiar with Crimea, which was that where Russia just walked in and took over that port. 160,000 Russian troops. I don't care if they have separatists with them or not. The Ukraine is a large country, and I think that a lot of Americans are thinking that the Russians can just walk in and take over the whole country. If this does come, push comes to shove, and it goes to war, it's not going to be that easy for the Russians.
Well, no strategist will tell you that it's easy to roll into any country, but it's certainly not easy to roll into and take over Ukraine. One parallel might be the 1968 invasion by Soviet Russia of Czechoslovakia, not as big a country by any means. And of course, the political lie of the landscape was very different then. I mean, that was an action taken within the context of the so-called Warsaw Pact, the Soviets' version of NATO, if you like. It was a strange concept to put it, and strange to put it this way, perhaps, but that was an invasion between friends. In fact, the pretext in that particular case was to say that there was an invitation from the Czechoslovak Communist Party to the Kremlin to come in and help them deal with the dangerous anti-revolutionary movements that was going on at the time, what was called the Prague Spring of 1968. Modern-day Ukraine would no longer tied to the Soviet Empire or tied down by the Soviet Empire, perhaps, might have been a way to describe how it was. Now an independent country, and as you say, vast in itself, its armed forces, well, perhaps not strong enough to withstand the Putin forces that he's kept in pretty good and well-resourced shape. But, you know, predicting the way that a war might go is an absolute fool's game, and no journalist should engage in it, I don't think. But, of course, what's been very clear is that as we were saying right at the beginning, nations could get so much capital out of posturing for war, almost as much as they could if they were to actually step into active militaristic attacking mode. I think what's going on is a lot of shadow boxing here. But it shouldn't be downplayed just because it's shadowing. It's extremely dangerous. We stand at a very critical moment in our modern history here. It's the biggest military movement in decades in that part of Europe. So we shouldn't downplay it. But on the other hand, we shouldn't think that it's going to take place in some easy and fast-moving and fast-finishing way. That's not going to be the case, I don't think.
You would think that and I'll put the United States in this, you would think that the major powers, after their record over the past 40 years of going into countries, the United States just getting out of 20 years in Afghanistan, and before that, of course, Iraq and Russia, their miscues that happened in Afghanistan as well. You would figure that they would learn from that famous quote, if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it.
Well, yes, and of course we concentrate perhaps inevitably because we are in the West about the powerful nations of the West, like the United States in particular, making the terrible mistake of thinking they can interfere in other countries' fortunes and control the outcome. And the outcome is very far from easy to control. The Russians too have that experience. The very fact that the Soviet empire collapsed was in large part to do with a miscalculation they made, the Soviets made, by invading Afghanistan. That was the beginning of the end of the Soviet empire. So yes, history is almost doomed to repeat itself sometimes if you don't learn from it. I don't know if that's playing part of the Kremlin's calculations at the moment, but it certainly ought to.
David, always great to speak to you. Of course, themediabeat.us is your website. We'll speak to you again next week, and hopefully things will calm down in the world.
Well, we'll see.
Take care, David.
You too.
David Terechuk with The Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. And, of course, you can find The Media Beat at robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand. Click on David Terechuk with The Media Beat. And, as I said, David's own website, which is themediabeat.us.